This is Dissecting Dragons, a speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers.
Hello and welcome to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers. I'm Madeleine Vaughan.
And I'm Jules Ironside. This week, we all deserve to die, killing off characters the right way in speculative fiction.
Now, I feel this week has been inspired by things that we've been watching quite recently, but as Jules and I kind of discussed where we were going to go with this episode, we kept finding more and more topics to talk about and particular areas for this subject. So we've got quite a lot to do, but obviously this episode isn't going to come with a spoiler warning, because usually people dying in books at the end.
Yes, or, you know, it's usually quite a major plot point if it's a major character. So, spoiler alert, if it's something that hasn't been published yet that I've read, but I know it's not published until September or whatever, I will do my best not to be spoilery on that account. But otherwise, you can expect a few spoilers.
Yeah.
Let's talk just very, very generally about how we feel about killing off characters in general. Let's talk generally about something in general. Yeah, that's really great grammar. Okay. Right, aside from that, I've just killed grammar, by the way, so I'm very sorry, everyone. You can now no longer use grammar because now it's dead. So there's that. I feel like we should say we are specifically talking about killing fictional characters. I'm not saying that I think there's some nut job out there thinking we're doing a how to, you know, a murder 101 class or something. But just in case, just to cover all bases.
You mean this isn't a murder 101 class? Oh, I've been tricked.
You were in the wrong place. You were in the wrong place with that. Right. yeah. Sometimes someone needs to die in a book or a film or whatever. And there are very good reasons for it to happen. And we might not like it happening. Maybe we've really bonded with that character. Or maybe we're just like, we don't really care at all. But either way, it has to be done in the right way. You can't just throw in deaths willy-nilly. And some perfectly good examples of speculative fiction have been completely ruined by the author going, I guess I'll just kill them then. It doesn't work. And all the producers or the directors or whoever, just killing off a character randomly. I suppose sometimes with films and series, if the actor leaves or, you know, actually dies in real life, it can't be avoided. But it's still not quite, you know, it doesn't hold up to scrutiny in terms of structure and understanding a character arc or a story journey. So that's kind of where we're coming from today. And we're going to start off with good reasons to kill off your characters in a book. And then we'll look at some of the bad reasons, including some of my personal pet peeves. So be prepared for ranty pants, because that might happen. I'm warning you now. And then we'll go on from there. And we'll bring in some, obviously, examples as we go on through.
Okay, all right. So good reasons to kill off characters. I think probably, and this is one which authors have actually talked about for a long time, whereby people have sent in complaints saying, why did you kill this character? They were my favourite character. And the response was, you realise this book is about a war, right?
Yes.
Unfortunately, in war, people die.
Yeah, and that is a good reason. The plot demands it. Now, yes, you have to be a bit careful how you do it, because perhaps the plot demands it, but why that character? And I think when you're killing a character, the first thing you should ask yourself is, would they serve the plot better by living or by dying?
Yes.
And if you can't say, well, their death actually makes more of an impact and drives the plot more in a, it drives it in a better way, it makes the book more dynamic, or it makes the entire character journey more visceral, or does something for the main characters, then they're probably better off living.
Yes.
So there's that one. But you're quite right. If it's a war and presumably you're doing something like a sprawling epic and you have lots of side characters and things, and you're going to end up killing someone's favourite character. There's no getting away from it. Because having a big war scene where all the main characters survive is, it stretches credulity, unless you can explain it somehow.
Yeah.
Guess which book I'm thinking of.
I know exactly which book you're thinking of. not to name and shame, but you are definitely talking about A Court of War and Ruin.
Wings of Ruin.
Wings of... Sorry, I got confused for a second. I knew it was a W, I just couldn't remember what it was for.
Yes, which is Sarah J. Maas, and it's the third book in the A Court of Thorns and Roses series. Without going into it too much, because I get quite rabid about that third book, which is putting it mildly, and I don't actually want to fling any verbal beanie babies today, not yet anyway. But there is this massive, massive setup for a sprawling war at the end, and all the main characters come through it just fine, ultimately. And we're not even allowed a moment or a couple of chapters of worrying about a character. So even when someone gets badly injured in a way that should be fatal, but you hope that it won't be, we're not allowed to sit and stew in our own juices. And it's just, it's an incredible failing. And I think a lot of that comes down to mindset and the fact that perhaps you're so attached to your characters, you've not been able to emotionally shut yourself off and say, I love you, but you need to suffer now. Which makes me sound like, you know, a bit of a psychopath, probably. But, you know, there is a process behind this. Ultimately, your character's not your children, and you do need to torture them. And you should make your readers worry. They should be, they should genuinely have concern that a character is not going to survive, or genuinely feel it when a character does die.
Yeah. And I think it comes down to consequence. And I've mentioned this before, but just as you said earlier, Jules, you ask yourself, is the death of this character going to drive the plot forward? And would they actually serve it better if they were alive? And better yet, why have I chosen to kill this particular character? Because I think we'll address this later about bad reasons to kill, but, you know, the whole sort of... the need to kill off LGBT characters, the need to kill off women to create man pain. And I'm guilty of it. I've done it as well. But, you know, anyway, we'll talk more about that later on. But it comes down to that question of the consequences of killing this character. Does this character need to die in order for the next part of the plot to happen? Even if it is painful, if it is yes, then yeah, it should happen. But more importantly than that, if characters continuously get into situations whereby they should have died time and time again, or they should have at least come out, you know, scarred or scratched, but don't, then you lose a great portion of that suspension in your story, because we're now no longer worried about this character. There's no sense of consequence for whatever they do. They can just sort of get through it, and it's absolutely fine, which actually makes them less interesting, and removes the impact when something does happen, because we say, okay, well, all right, so let's use A Court of Wings and Ruin for an example. Someone literally gets gutted, and then they're like fine in half an hour. And I just thought, actually, I kind of wanted it to be a little bit more, you know, I wanted to be worried a little bit more, but we didn't actually have any reason to worry. We just saw the aftermath after they were already being healed, and then they were absolutely fine and there wasn't a problem at all. And I just thought, it just means that I no longer care. If there isn't a chance that the characters could die, then all that the characters could at least suffer greatly, then I'm not going to care about it. So that kind of death always sort of needs to be, death always needs to be on the table. It really does depend what you're writing about. You know, if it's like Bridget Jones's Diary, or, you know, you're writing like a romance, death doesn't need to be on the table quite as much. But if you are writing about this war, death does need to be on the table. And I think the best way of showing that death is on the table is, you know, allowing it to take a few of the players.
Yeah, someone dies. It's funny you mentioned Bridget Jones's Diary, because one of the deaths that hit me most hard and genuinely actually made me cry, and this is a few years ago now, admittedly, was Bridget Jones Mad About the Boy. And you start off the book feeling really uncomfortable because Darcy's disappeared. And you're like, where is he? Why is she now a 50-year-old woman who's kind of flirting with this 30-year-old? And as you go on, you find out exactly what happened to him. And, okay, it basically it is a character death.
Yeah.
And it's not magnificent. It's not for any... It's one of those sort of, this reflects real life, as in death can be senseless. And I think it was an amazing balance between death can be senseless, these things happen, as in basically his vehicle when he was being, you know, top political lawyer got bombed. So yeah. Death was senseless, but at the same time, it really acted to drive Bridget's plot forwards. And there she was left alone as a widowed mother of two. Mm-hmm. And how she then regained her equilibrium and got her life back and, you know, kind of found love again.
Yeah.
Helen Fielding is an absolutely amazing, I know this isn't speculative fiction, but the way she manipulates your emotions between humour and tragedy is absolutely amazing. And I'd advise everybody to read the Bridget Jones series for that reason. Forget the films. The films aren't very intelligently done. They're funny, but they're kind of slapstick. The way she does it in the books, it's just utterly perfect.
Yeah.
Okay, other good reasons to kill off a character. This is a weirdly obvious one, but the book is told from the point of view of a dead character.
Yes, but...
So somebody has had to die. I mean, this is one I stumble across because I write a lot of ghost stories. So at some point, someone will have had to die. And one of the things with a ghost story is that it's teaching you about confronting death. So you quite often then have to deal with that dead character's death at some point during the narrative. And that can still be a character death. That is still a character being killed off. It's just you've learned to love this character after they've already died. And you kind of want them to live even though they haven't.
Yeah. It's kind of worse. I tell you what, it's worse for writers as well. The amount of times that I've started a book knowing a character is already dead or knowing a character is going to die, and then I develop them and I'm like, oh no!
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
I have regrets.
Okay, another example that this is a bit of a your mileage may vary type example. And it's not right all the time. And I suppose with a lot of writer rules, no rule is right all the time. But you have a character who is too much competition. They contribute something to the plot, but there comes a point when they no longer contribute. They're actually competition for the limelight.
So
if you ask yourself the question of, should the book actually be about this character and not your main character? And you still come out with, no, the main character is equally strong. It's just that they now try and occupy the same niche. Then you need to kill that character. That character needs to die somehow, even if it's a ritual death in the sense of that character gets removed from the plot some other way.
Yeah, even if you don't actually murder the character, even if they just leave or something like that. Or
yeah.
Yeah, that's okay. But yeah, they need to die. They need to be removed. You know, out of context, this conversation sounds really menacing.
It really sounds bad. They need to die. Play some Slipknot.
For your chosen. They need to die.
My final main reason for killing off a character is quite a difficult one to conceptualize, and that is that the character's death conveys the premise or the main theme that you've been trying to communicate through the book. So this sort of character death comes at the very end, usually. Yeah. So if you think of things like The Book Thief, now there's lots of death in that because it's World War II and it's Germany and terrible things are happening. Mm-hmm. Our main character, I want to say Liesl. It is Liesl, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Our main character, Liesl, does survive to the end of the book, way past World War II, but she's in serious jeopardy all the way through. But her best friend Rudy doesn't. And when he dies, it's really, really tragic. But his death serves as it serves the theme of the book. I mean, the book's being narrated by Death, and Death is saying how pointless all this death is, which is quite a juxtaposition already. And then to really hammer that home, Rudy dies. And then at the end of the book, Death and Liesl properly meet for the first time, even though Death has kind of been with her all throughout her life because she fascinates him. And she sort of goes with him like he's an old friend. But again, the character dies. So it's the juxtaposition between senseless early death caused by atrocities such as war and the concentration camps, and a life that's been lived as best as you possibly can, even though terrible things have happened around you. So her death at the end of the book, again, really hammers home this theme.
No, you're absolutely right that it does. I'm trying to think of I had another example, and now it literally has just gone out of my head of that. But yeah, in terms of when you have a book which is about war, or about, you know, the senselessness of things, of these kinds of atrocities, it doesn't really make sense for there not to be death at the end. Again, not speculative fiction, but The Boy in the Striped Pyjamas.
Yeah.
Another excellent example of actually where really it couldn't have really ended any other way, could it? You kind of want it to have really ended in any other way.
And it's that slow unwinding of horror, because you know how it's going to end and you still hope for a last minute reprieve.
Yeah.
And it's the fact that it really is like the war between innocence and experience, and he never actually wins that war. He never gets to become anything other than innocent, because he never fully understands exactly what the concentration camps are until he's killed in one of the chambers.
And I think it's the reason is that that happens is because it's, as you said, you want for there to be another ending. You're desperate for something to intervene or to stop it from happening. But that's the whole point, is that you're meant to kind of leave the book with this sense of helplessness, with this sense of despair, with this sense of horror, because that's what the book is about. It's about a senseless, despairing, horrible time in history. And that being good or being innocent or being a child wasn't enough to get you away from that.
Yeah, exactly. So in that instance, the character death serves to reinforce the theme of the book, if people have managed to miss it up until that point. I'm going to say there's no other logical way for it to happen, as you said.
Yeah. And you do see it particularly in books which are about the world wars in particular. It's the same with Goodnight, Mr. Tom. I know we're kind of off topic. It's kind of historical fiction. That's my excuse. you see it with Goodnight, Mr. Tom as well. The name is just gone out of my head. Sorry, please ignore me.
No. So yeah, just to recap those four points, either for reasons to kill your character include the book is told from the point of view of a dead person, the character's death contributes to the MC's character journey or drives the plot in a significant way, which they would not be able to do if they were alive. The character's death serves to remove a direct competition for the hotspot, you know, with caveats, obviously. And the fourth one is the character's death conveys the theme premise of the book. So those are the four really good reasons for killing off a character. So if you're going to kill a character, it really should probably be for one of those four. Although if you can think of others that you think are valid, please let us know. We'd like to hear them.
And please remember, this is in terms of characters, not in terms of
fictional
characters. Yes, please.
Right, so reasons not to kill off a character. And I've got "not" in like caps, underlined about six times, but some of these are like my personal pet peeves. We will come to the whole fridging diversity debacle, I think, as the last point on the list, because that could get quite fraught.
Yes.
But first of all, unnecessary characters or too many characters. And I see this a lot in, I suppose, it seems to be a horror genre thing to a certain extent, because obviously with horror you tend to kill off more characters and you tend to kill them off quite early on before they've had a chance to really grow on your audience. And sometimes in epic fantasy as well. We'll look at examples in a minute. But basically, if you're killing off characters because you don't know what to do with them, those characters don't belong in that book. You should not be writing unnecessary characters. Same if you think, I've got too many characters, I don't know what to do with them. They don't actually belong in that book. If they're not driving the plot in a meaningful way, even as tertiary characters or fourth tier characters, then they don't deserve to be in the book. Maybe they belong in a book of their own, but they shouldn't be there just for you to kill them off.
Yeah. Yeah, you're absolutely right. This is the difference between having a character who no longer drives the plot. So they were introduced because they did initially drive the plot, but now you can kill them because they're not actually giving you anything anymore. Again, this conversation sounds really, really nasty.
It's dark, isn't it? But yeah, it's the idea of, you know, if somebody's as we've said, if we've got a character competing for the limelight and it's not their story, then you would be killing off that character in some way, removing them from the main arc, because now they're dead weight. And again, sounds very dark, but that's just the way it is. Other reasons not to kill off a character, this is like one of my ultimate bugbears, contrivance and shock value. So let's some of these sort of bleed together a bit, but what I mean by contrivance, you've got to a point in your book or your series and you don't maybe you've been quite successful and people are now theorizing about where it's going to end, and people are, you can't help seeing fan theories and things, and some part of you wants to do something that they will not expect. So what you do is you create a just for reason situation whereby a character dies and it serves no purpose, and that's contrivance. My specific example for this one is Allegiant, the third book in Veronica Roth's Divergent series, because we are not prepared from this. Basically, she kills off her main character. She kills her off for the stupidest of reasons. She would have served the plot and, you know, the entire arc of everything so much better if she'd lived. And we're not prepared. That's the real problem. If you intend to kill off your main character or any of your main characters, you need to prepare your readers for this eventuality very subtly, but you need to prepare them from the beginning of the series. You should be letting little hints bleed in. I mean, technically, Harry Potter dies, doesn't he? And you have been prepared for that from the very, very beginning. And gradually, as Harry starts to realise that what his ultimate destiny is to die for people, then you, as a reader, also realise at the same time. So you're being carefully prepared to, you know, to expect this character death. And I think it's still quite traumatic, even though you know it's going to happen. What you can't do is just go in the second to last chapter of your final book, go, I'm going to kill that character, and just kill them. Because you haven't prepared anyone for it. That's contrivance, that's shock value. And that is like the worst reason to kill a character, bar one.
Yeah. No, I think you're absolutely right. And also, particularly if you then do it and it actually makes telling your story harder.
Yes.
There's no point.
Yeah, I mean, I'm thinking about things like the original trilogy of The Vampire Diaries by Lisa Jane Smith. They're not flawless books, but Elena actually dies in the third book properly. I mean, she dies once in the second book because she gets turned into a vampire, so technically she's already died once. And then she dies properly as a vampire permanently, ignore the books that came after, in the third book. And it really knocks you for six. And for a long time, until Lisa Jane Smith went a bit doolally and started producing really, really bonkers sequels, that was it. That trilogy ended with Elena dying, and you just get Elena's best friend, Bonnie, summing up what happened afterwards at the end. Mm. And it was supposed to be kind of tragical, but it suited that character up, because Elena starts off as a really selfish, self-involved person, and who never did all the right things, who wasn't always sweetness and light, but through her character journey learned to be more than being just out for herself.
Yeah.
So it made sense for her to do that. She saw an opportunity and she took it, and she died and everybody else lived. And she considered that a fair trade when she did it. So that worked. The way that Allegiant set it up was just, I don't know. I don't know if you can be saccharine about somebody being self-sacrificing, but that's how it came across.
Yeah. It was unnecessary, and actually ultimately didn't add anything at all.
No, definitely not. And I think that's the thing, is you have to think of the whole, you get this sunk cost fallacy with books, and a reader invests in a series and they go on further and further and further into the series, and they're giving of their time to read your books. So if you then decide to just pull a contrivance on them at the very end, that's a real slap in the face. You're saying, well, there you go, your time wasn't worth anything. So yes, yeah, you should do what the plot demands, but you should also, you know, let's have some decent planning and prepare your readers for stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's also, it's a betrayal. There's no point. You can have a character who is self-sacrificing, and that's a big part of who they are. But if you then basically just, how do I explain this? sorry, I'm trying to, if you kill them just to say, look, I killed them because it was in their character that they're self-sacrificing, then actually you haven't really achieved anything. Because if you literally just killed them to show us that they were self-sacrificing, if that was a key part of their character anyway, we probably already knew. And something which has a lot more impact is either someone who isn't self-sacrificing, or someone who is self-sacrificing but has found a reason to actually live. Now, there's a good example of this, and I know we've talked about, we had an episode about Avengers Endgame, but I do just want to very quickly talk about Tony Stark.
Yeah.
Now, Tony Stark, throughout the, from when he started, he was not particularly self-sacrificing. He was very selfish, he was narcissistic, but after, you know, he was captured in the first film and, you know, he was tortured, he became very self-deprecating. He did become very self-sacrificing. And actually, through every subsequent film, he does acts which put him directly in harm's way. And he's very, even though he, in the second one, for instance, he doesn't want to die, he continuously does things which kind of suggest that he is a little bit suicidal, that actually he doesn't really mind the concept of dying, and he's battling with himself about it, because on the one side he doesn't mind and he doesn't think he's worth much, but on the other side he is afraid and he's terrified and he's been traumatized. But he doesn't, he continuously does things whereby he puts himself in harm's way, and it's because he doesn't really care completely whether he lives or dies, that he puts other things in front of it. And he comes through, he always survives every time. But in the last film, for the first time ever, Tony Stark wants to live. He 100% wants to live. He 100% has something to come back to, something which is incredibly important, something which matters almost as much as the entire rest of the world. And that's, of course, his wife and his daughter. And so his death then isn't quite as unsatisfactory. It's more tragic, because that is then the ultimate sacrifice. He hasn't just sacrificed it because he didn't actually care about himself. He sacrificed it because he was giving up on something which really, really mattered to him. You know, he kind of sacrificed his daughter and the rest of his life with his daughter. And that's significant. So in that way, it's okay to have a character who is self-sacrificial. But if you're going to make them sacrifice themselves at the end, they've got to be losing something. It can't just be because it's continuously been their character.
Yeah, absolutely. And yeah, you can have a character who flirts with suicide and who is nihilistic in their outlook, like Tony Stark is. But as you say, his death would have meant nothing really if he'd died in any of the previous films, whereas it did actually mean something in that one. And I think the most important metric of that is the fact that it kind of felt right. I mean, it wasn't something he necessarily wanted to happen, but it felt right in that respect. As a sidebar, Steve Rogers is also kind of a death in that film, in narrative terms, because he's removed himself from the narrative by finally going and he's sort of done a mirror of Tony Stark. Tony Stark had sort of lived quite selfishly for a very long period of time and then did something so utterly unselfish. Yeah. And Steve Rogers had lived unselfishly all the time and finally did something else to live. He finally lived just for himself through the time hopping, and again removed himself from the Avengers in the same way. So it does count as a character death. So where we were talking about removing a competing character from the narrative, you can't have another Captain America while you've got the original one still there. So the old one has to die, but he didn't have to physically die in order for it to happen.
No, he didn't. It could just be his character or his position in the story died, was removed.
Yeah, so it was a ritual death in that respect.
Yeah, giving away. And it was kind of important. And that didn't just happen kind of for it happened for all of the major Avengers, whereby they kind of, either they physically died or the position they held died, and they moved on to allow space for this next generation to come forward.
Yeah. Right. Let's move on to the slightly more contentious topic of fridging and the adjacent topic of, you know, the whole diversity loophole that goes with it. Basically, as authors, sometimes somebody needs to die, and they don't need to be somebody that we're particularly attached to. It's just a way of setting the stakes. And while I would say that no character should be wheeled on just to die, or in monster terms, no character should exist just to get eaten, and no woman should exist just to get raped so that men can get annoyed, you have to give them some characterization. At the same time, you don't necessarily need to give them full backstory so that they could run off and have their own novellas or whatever, necessarily.
Yeah.
So these are what you would call like the spear carriers. You know, they're part of the army, they make up part of the force, but ultimately they're not the star of the show.
No.
They're not the leaders, they're not the movers and shakers.
No.
The problem with this is the fact that in an attempt to include diversity and better representation of women, LGBTQ people, disabled people, etc., in fiction, authors who don't really know what they're doing make these spear carrier characters one of those minority groups, and then they kill them off. So what you get is this ripple effect of lots of gay people dying, or trans people dying, or POC people dying, well, lots of women dying in order to create man pain. Fridging's a slightly different issue, but we will talk about that as well.
Yeah.
And largely, I think it's because authors are kind of like, well, I want to be able to say that, you know, I've got a gay character in there. I said, yeah, but you killed them in 5 minutes. That's not representation. In fact, that's really, really bad.
Yeah. And it literally comes from the fact that you say, we want the world to be diverse. And I really should make this up. It's very important to recognise that killing a person of colour in fiction, or a queer person in fiction, or a woman in fiction, it's okay to do that. The problem comes if they are the only or part of a very small group that you are representing. So, for instance, if your main character sexual, okay, and the second main character or the close group has got a person of colour and women and things like that, and then in the background you also have some other bisexual character or some gay characters or whatever, and they get killed, then actually it doesn't sting quite as much, because all you've done there is you basically said, yes, the world is diverse and bad things happen to people, and those foot soldiers are not all one particular kind of person. The spear holders, as you say, the spear holders, they're not all one particular kind of person. They have, you know, lots of different, you know, personalities, lives, etc. That's absolutely fine. But what happens is, really, people say, right, my main character has to be a straight white male. And they can only really be a straight white male. And their best friend, maybe I'll allow their best friend to be a person of colour, but really, probably the best friend male as well. And they'll have that kind of the group. And then, so you'll have the inner circle, where everyone is straight and white. And you may have one woman and two men, And then you have the circle just outside of it. And that circle is when they go, right, now we can have some diversity. But the circle outside of it are also constantly at risk because it's meant to be, look, they're close enough to make it hurt if we kill them, but they're distant that I can keep the plot going without them. So they're distant enough that I can keep the plot going without them. But that means that if you're diverse, the diverse group are only in that second or third or fourth ring, which are the kill rings,
yes,
you've got an issue. And unfortunately, what's happened is that people, and I think they've done it well, trying to be well-meaning, they've tried to say, yeah, let's get some more diversity. Yeah. We're not sure we can risk making the main characters diverse, but let's try and bring in some diversity. But unfortunately, they put them in the sections where the death toll is high. And that has meant that continuously, you've had those kinds of deaths. And I think the other problem is that it plays into what you were talking about earlier, Jules, about people, and this actually works in the reverse, where you say we've killed them in order to tell a specific kind of story. So, you know, we kill people when we're writing a story about war because the story is about war or about death. And I think what happens when it comes in particular to LGBT and people, you know, members of the LGBT community or people of color, is that we say this is a story about how hard life is for them. And in order to hard life is for them, we gotta kill them. You know, we've gotta kill them because this is about the violence they face every single day and the fact that their lives are so miserable. And that's actually where there's been a problem instead, where basically they said this is exactly the only way that life is for a certain bunch of people, and that means that we cannot possibly portray a hopeful or happy ending because it's just unrealistic.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's obviously, if you do a fully realized character who occupies a decent space within a book, who is part of, or even intersectionally part of, several minorities, that's great. And yes, you can kill that character. You might discover as you go on that maybe that character needs to die. But as Madeline says, if that is the only example in your book, then you've got a real problem. If you don't have other POC characters, if you don't have other queer characters or other disabled characters in your book, then yes, killing off that one's going to be a real issue. Even if you have done your homework and you have given them a backstory and agency and real characterization, because what you're doing is you're putting all of this on one character and then you're removing them. So it's not a case of, no, you cannot kill that character if it's a major part of their arc, and that their death, perhaps they are the best friend and, you know, their death will drive the plot forward significantly. But if they are the only example, then you've killed the only example. You realise you're not diverse anymore because you have removed the only example. It made sense in Buffy the Vampire Slayer in the sixth season for Tara to die, but she was only one half of a gay couple, the only gay couple in the entire season, in the entire series up until that point, in fact. So killing her off, yes, it made sense in those terms, and I know the actress also left, and it did drive the big bad guy for the end of that film, who was a good guy who sort of traded capes. But it became problematic in the sense of, yeah, you've killed one of the only gay characters. So it was a main character, she was a most beloved character as well, and you had this really interesting dynamic with her and the rest of the group and her and her girlfriend, etc., etc. But there were no other examples in that series at all, so it became quite an issue.
Yeah. And that is where it comes into it, because the death can make total sense and it can still be not a good idea. And it really does come down to, actually, you've got to think about what you've got left and what message you are sending with a certain death as well.
Yeah. If you are removing the only example, then you need to go back and put in more examples.
Yeah.
Ultimately, that's what it comes down to.
Now, there's another example of something that happened like this. Me before you, and again, I know it's not speculative fiction, but I just kind of want to mention it. Now, I've never read the book. I'll admit, I've not read the book, and I have not seen the film. All I know is that I've known several disabled people and disabled friends who've basically given their thoughts on it. So all I can say is from what I've learned from them and from what I know of the plot, which is that obviously you have this it's this couple, they fall in love. He's badly disabled. He's almost entirely paralyzed, I believe.
Quadriplegic.
And basically, at the end, that's it. At the end, he decides to be euthanized. He wants to commit suicide. He doesn't want to live like this.
Yeah, the thing is, he starts the film wanting that. He starts the book wanting that. His position doesn't change throughout.
Yeah. And I think it may have made sense in terms of the character. And there are people who have opted for that, who have said, actually, I don't want to live like this. I'm in too much pain. I would prefer to die. And I can totally, I can appreciate that that is a reality for some people. But when you have a film which has, which represents, or a book which represents, considering how little disability is represented in films in general, or in books in general, in the media in general, when you have something which, finally represents an extremely underrepresented people, and the ending is, and it was better for everyone if he just died, you can kind of understand why people got upset.
Well, I can understand why people got upset. That's not really how it comes across in either the book or the film, but I can understand why people felt it was that way. I don't really have a horse in this race, except that I can see both perspectives here. But yeah, I think the real problem, again, is that you have one example and it's being forced to bear the weight of an entire spectrum, because there are
Yeah.
people who become quadriplegic and feel like that. And there are people who become quadriplegic and they don't feel like that at all. They may not feel like that from the beginning. I will say this from the position of having met and worked with people through various jobs who have accidents and become quadriplegic. And I can think of one guy who said a year after his life was saved, he came off a motorbike and fractured his spine from the neck down. He was paralysed. And a year later, he was still saying, "I wish you'd left me to die. I don't want to live like this." Okay, that's valid. That's how he feels. And there was another guy, almost exactly
Yeah.
the same sort of argument, and he was saying, his initial thoughts were, "God, I can't cope like this." And then a month later, he was kind of like, "I'm so grateful I'm still alive." And then a year later, he was like, "I'm loving my life. I'm still enjoying my life. I'm still interacting with everything. It's difficult, but I'm so grateful that I'm still alive." So you
Yeah.
genuinely can't see how someone's gonna jump, and there's a big spectrum in between. And the problem is that that particular film and book only presented one perspective, and there's not enough other examples to compare it to.
Yeah, and I completely agree with that. Again, I haven't seen it, I haven't read it, and from all accounts, it's had some good reviews. A lot of people have really enjoyed it, and it literally just does suffer from the fact that it is one of the very few pieces of media that represents disability. It represents a rather tragic outcome
Yeah.
of that kind of disability rather than a hopeful one. And there aren't actually that many examples of hopeful ones. And the problem is that when people decide to write about disability or being queer or being a person of color, the fact of the matter is they say it's got to be a tragedy. That's what's going to be most powerful. They decide rather than to show hopeful things or happy things or happily ever afters. They decide that a story worth telling with these kinds of characters has got to be tragic. So that's something you definitely need to look out for. Why? What is your what is your motivation for killing a certain character? And even if it makes sense in the story, consider the impact of what will happen when you do kill them and whether there's anything you can do to remedy that at all.
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, the story that needs to be told is the story that needs to be told. But at the same time, you should be asking yourself questions all the way through, and you should know why it needs to be told in a certain way.
Absolutely.
And always do your due diligence. With that in mind, let's just quickly mention fridging before we go on to talking specifically about killing your protagonist.
Yes.
Fridging is obviously mostly applied to killing off a female character in order to allow a man to feel something.
Yes.
Generally, these female characters are wheeled on. It's nearly always the dead wife who was killed by the enemy, and therefore, mm-hmm. you know, the man will never love in the same way again, etc., etc. He's a kind of a tortured hero. And it's
yeah.
just, it's really, really bloody annoying. We've mentioned this before, so there's no need to go into too much detail, but basically 80% of the reading public is female, and all we're seeing is in the small 30% of characters included by male writers, most of them are very minor, and a lot of them are women who just get killed off in order to make the men feel something. That's toxic. There's got to be a better way of doing things, definitely. So
yeah. it is literally because these women represent the softer side of the men, which means that we've got to kill that softer side.
Yeah.
We've got to kill that safe harbor, and that's all women are.
Yeah, it's incredibly frustrating. And I suppose a subspecies of this is the fact that of this particular terrible trope is having the black character die for the white MC.
Yeah.
Again, so these are just sort of like, we could go on and on about this, but literally just ask yourself these questions. Why is it happening this way?
Yeah. Now, I am going to say that I'm guilty of fridging. I did fridge a character in The Sons of Thestian, but I justify myself because I fridged them for a very particular reason, and it actually wasn't just for the man pain. I fridged Mylène Rossignol specifically because I wanted a Benya, or a Banshee. And the only way I could create a Banshee was I could have had a random Banshee, but actually I wanted this Banshee to be someone who was linked in with the main characters, linked in with the main story, for other reasons later on as well. And also for the tragedy, and I wanted it was a tragedy for this character as well as for Rufus.
I think
too.
The thing is, I would disagree with you. I don't think that was fridging. That was a tragic part of Rufus's backstory, but it wasn't fridging because it didn't drive the entire plot for him. It just formed
no.
part of his character.
Yeah. But the problem was that I knew she was dead before I even started, but then I was writing about her and I was like, oh, suddenly it hurts.
Yeah, on that note, let's talk about killing your protagonist, which should be relatively short, and then mm-hmm. we'll talk about our own character deaths. I was going to say our own deaths, but that sounded quite morbid. Character deaths. So killing off your protagonist. Ultimately, yes, you can do this. You really need to think about who you're writing for and what story you're telling, and are you preparing your reader? So, for example, in young adult and new adult, you probably would not be killing off your main characters unless, for example, it is a story about two teens beautifully dying of cancer, to paraphrase Patrick Ness. Because obviously, if you're starting from the position of, like, The Fault in Our Stars, which is actually a very good book, then your characters have cancer at the start, so you know there's a high probability that there's a heartbreak factor involved before you get to the end. You're preparing
yeah.
your readers. If you're telling a coming-of-age, light, humorous, epic fantasy, and you kill your protagonist at the end, you've just fucked up your entire story.
Yeah. I think an example of a main character dying, which shouldn't have worked and yet actually 100% worked and was exactly right, was the death of Ned Stark at the beginning of Game of Thrones.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the ones that's kind of an exception because, yes, it tapped into shock factor and, yes, it tapped into sort of the whole unnecessary character thing because he had nothing further to do except die, so it's also kind of killing off the competing character. So George R.R. Martin has skillfully managed to tick both the reasons you should kill off your character box and the reasons you shouldn't kill off your character box at the same time. And it absolutely worked because it prepared us for the series. We weren't prepared for that death specifically in the book, but it did prepare us for the series. It let us know that nobody was golden and nobody was safe, which was an important part of the whole Song of Ice and Fire series.
Yep. I'm trying to think of examples of deaths which were just 100% unnecessary. And you've obviously already mentioned Divergent.
Yeah. There have been others, I think. The trouble is now, I've read a lot of YA where a main character dies, and I'm like, why did that happen? And I'm so disengaged because the authors seem to be writing this thin narrative that doesn't actually really connect me to the characters in a meaningful way. There's an example, Star Trek Discovery, the second season, which is an absolute pig's ear, in my opinion. There is she's not an artificial life form. She's sort of like a woman who had a terrible accident and was biomechanically revived. So I think a tiny part of her brain is still organic and still originally her, and she's alive. She survived the accident through that. We're given no preparation for that character at all. She's just a random robot-looking chick in the first season, and she's like that again all the way up through the second season of Star Trek Discovery, right up until an episode where they need to make Michael Burnham feel something. So they do this by bringing this random character to the fore, spending half of that particular episode showing us random scenes with this character that they've spent no time on before, with her friends and how much she's loved, etc. And then a bit more later into the episode, it's less about info dump about her backstory, then you get a tiny bit of action for the overarching plot. She and Michael end up in quite a difficult position where Michael is being forced to think whether she has to kill someone or not because this woman's neural net, which is biomechanical, has been hijacked and she can't control herself, so it's kind of a kill or be killed situation. And the biomechanical woman's saying, you know, blast me out the airlock, etc., etc. And yeah, she does die. And it is the biggest fucking wank fest. It really, really is, because we don't know anything about this character. They've literally info dumped it on us in the beginning of that episode. They've shown her to us all the way up through, but, you know, she's just a random sort of walk-on part up until then. And then we're supposed to be really, really upset that she's dead, and we're supposed to feel sorry for Michael Burnham that she has had to kill this woman, or, you know, or that she's had to allow it to happen ultimately. In the end, it's the security chief that throws her out the airlock. And it's just, like, the worst... it is the worst conglomeration of killing off a character. It's absolutely ridiculous. You move somebody into the prime position of being a main character for an episode, and then you info dump, and then you kill them off for basically no reason at all. And it's just not, and they even hinted at a kind of gay relationship there as well, or a potential gay romance before they did it. And it's just,
of course they did.
I'm just like, what are you doing? See, second series of Star Trek Discovery is all about diversity, but it feels like there's too many people in the writer's room. It really does. This is not good representation. This is a bunch of people with a sheet of boxes to tick, and they are ticking them, but they are not telling good stories and they're not representing characters well.
And that is a problem.
It is a problem. So, yes, the main thing with killing off your protagonist is proper preparation. and it's the whole sort of proper preparation and planning prevents piss poor performance.
Yeah,
if you can say that fast.
Piss poor performance.
But yeah, it is. Yeah, it is really important to do that. And I can't spoilify you too much because this book doesn't even come out till September. It's definitely in my top five reads of the year so far. And that is Gideon mm-hmm. the Ninth by Tamsin Muir. This is a book that is billed as lesbian necromancers in space. And it Excellent. Delivers. It fucking delivers. It's really, really good. And it's kind of a murder mystery, and it's kind of like trials, kind of like the Hunger Games, but more sort of like thinky type trials. And I can't do it justice. There's lots of character deaths in that, and they are characters that you care about because, you know, people need to die in order for you to feel this sense of jeopardy. And then there's the whole, you know, they're necromancers, they're not really the good guys. But there's one very specific character death that happens at the end, and I did not see it coming, which is very, very rare for me. I didn't see it coming, and yet when it happened, I was horrified and upset and shocked, and at the same time I was like, oh my god, you prepared me from this for the very beginning. You completely, you basically told me this was going to happen without telling me. And that is how it should happen. That is how it should be done if you're going to kill off your protagonist.
Yeah, absolutely. But in terms of killing protagonists, so Jules, you write books about ghosts, so like death is a little inevitable.
Yeah, I'm just trying to think back how many characters I've killed. Ultimately, I killed off the mother before I even started the series.
You did.
And yeah, she stays dead, but she doesn't really stay gone entirely.
No, she has a presence, certainly.
And obviously there's a whole bunch of other characters who are sort of around as ghosts and spirits and various things. And then yeah. I think the first living character I kill off is, he's like a fourth tier character. It's Jez from the group in I Am the yeah. Silence. And he's the first person in that particular book that M's kind of feeling like, oh yeah, we could be friends. He was a bit of a dick, but actually he's not like that all the time. We could kind of be friends. So yeah. I developed his character and her relationship with him just enough that you would care when he was found dead in a church.
Yeah, just enough.
So, you know, it wasn't going to go well, but you had to feel that there was jeopardy. Somebody was going to die, and that could happen to your main character as well. And yes. In fact, I flirt with M nearly dying all the way up to I Rule the Night.
Yes, I mean, she practically almost does. You don't just flirt with death with M. I mean, she kind of basically does things where if anyone else did it, she'd be dead. I mean, I'd almost say she's kind of actually has died a few times. Or come very, very close.
Yeah, and in fairness, in I Rule the Night, she does technically die.
Yeah.
There are other things around it that mean that she obviously doesn't stay dead. There is also another slightly more major character death that happens in I Rule the Night as well.
Yes. And this one we were absolutely prepared for, because this character was actually already dead.
Yeah. Talking about Lucas, spoilers guys, if you haven't read the books and you think you might want to, but you meet Lucas in the second book, and he is inhabiting essentially the brain dead body of a teenage boy who got hit by a car, but he's really a 20 something year old man from the 18th century France. And yeah, he's sort of been wedged into this body. He didn't mean for it to happen, it just happened. But M decides that she's not going to send him on, because if she did, it would be the same as actually killing the body which he's giving life to.
Yeah.
And then you find various things out as you go further into the series. And then in I Rule the Night, he and M both end up trapped in the Vale with a big demon creature that's kind of like bent on marrying M. And it is the devourer. It's the devourer of souls. So once it's caught you outside your body, discard it. Then if it doesn't have another use for you, it'll just use you as a source of energy.
Yeah.
Which is not a great way to go.
No.
And I've been told by a lot of people that they were upset by this death of Lucas, but that it was a good death as well, that it was upsetting for them and that they didn't want it to happen, but at the same time, it was a good death. So I'm assuming that means they felt it wasn't contrived.
No, I don't think it was contrived at all. It made total sense, and we were building up to it, really. So I didn't find it contrived at all, but it was appropriately tragic. So thank you for that.
That's okay. I mean, what it did was it hit this character has stepped forwards, and now he's competing with one of the other main characters, in more ways than one. There's not enough room for both of them. So he needs to undergo some form of ritual death. And as it turned out, the best thing he could do for the entire plot was to die.
Yep. I still feel sorry for him.
Yeah, you're supposed to. He was kind of a dick as well. So not too sorry for him.
He was a dick. I wanted him to stop. I didn't want him to die.
I still, if you disagree with me, then that's fine. Obviously, anybody let me know. But I think it was probably the right way to kill off that character. And I was genuinely sorry when I did it. Initially, my initial plans were he was never going to make a reappearance after I Am the Silence. And then my editor said something, and I'm like, oh God, I've got to keep bringing him back. And I did have to keep bringing him back. And then he took a major role in the plot and drove the plot forward significantly up until the point where he was going to derail the whole thing if he stayed alive.
But that's because your editor wanted him to derail everything.
Yeah, my editor did have a particular preference in one direction there. He didn't get everything he wanted, but he did sort of say that, yeah, again, it was a good death. So there's that.
Whereas
Madeline, on the other hand, and it's kind of like George R. R. Martin, nobody's safe. Everyone's game. Everyone's fair game. Anyone could die. I might have to bring people back from the dead just to ensure she doesn't kill off some people I don't want her to kill. And I think you upset a few fans by killing off a specific character in your first book as well.
I did. A lot of people were incredibly unhappy with me. When I killed off, and here we are, spoilers for The Sons of Thestian, for anyone who hasn't read it yet. A lot of people were really upset when I killed off Yonathan.
Yeah.
And I was upset when I killed off Yonathan. When I was coming up with The Sons of Thestian, I was piecing it all together. I had the beginning, and I was kind of figuring out where does it go and what happens. And I got to the end and I went, he's got to die. There was no way around it. He had to die. And it wasn't just that I realized he had to die. I realized that it had been foreshadowed literally from the beginning. You know, you can't tell me that that actually it isn't. Because, and this is the best bit, my favorite thing is that my editor reread book one having read book two, and they just sent me continuously angry messages saying, how dare you, there's so much foreshadowing. I cannot believe I didn't recognize that this was what was going to happen. And I was like, well, yeah. You basically tell you from the start exactly who's going to die, but hey ho, there you go. So it did upset a lot of people, but it did need to happen, because if he hadn't died, there would have been no continuing story. There would have been no direction at all for what was then going to happen. There would have been none of the trigger changes which need to happen. And I think it was very important that he did die, because his death doesn't just trigger the beginning of this kind of revolt against the new king. Instead, it actually is this trigger for a much older war which has been happening between the Tuatha De Danann and the Fomori, and Morrigan is involved, and there's the Wild Hunt, and it also exposes this continuous line of treachery, and of basically of retaliation, whereby the Delphi have done something wrong, so the opposition have done something to retaliate, so the Delphi have done something to retaliate, and it's continued.
Yeah.
And if Yonathan had just taken the throne, that line, it would have continued, and there would have been no end to it. Whereas by him dying, all of the corruption is forward, and you see the wrongdoings of both sides. All this corruption is brought forward into the light, and Rufus is put into a position whereby he has to do something about it. And if Yonathan hadn't died, none of that would have happened, and none of what would then go on to happen would have happened. And it was all very important, and ultimately I think there would have been bad things. And Yonathan literally does see it. He says, if I survived, if I ran away, things like that, this is what would have happened, and you would have died, Rufus. And he recognizes that Rufus needs to be the one who lives, because Rufus will trigger this very dramatic and important change, which will alter the way that life is, and hopefully improve things. But I can't guarantee that. There's still a lot of shit to wade through.
You promise nothing. But again, a character death whereby their death serves more purpose than their life would, and what they need to do is die in order to further the plot.
Yes, absolutely. Now, I think we've run out of time.
Yeah, we are at the end of this episode. Obviously, do get in touch. Let us know about your favourite or not very favourite character deaths.
Or if you just want to rant at us for killing your fan favourite,
you tell us.
We'd love to hear it. Yeah, we're open to that too. It feeds us. Before we go, it is time for our Dissecting Dragons recommendation of the week. And this week, I've got one for you.
Okay.
Okay. So, I received a copy of this novella. It's a historical fiction. And it was written by Jules. It's Revolt, The King's Knight, Book One. It's the first of a trilogy. And I loved it. I absolutely loved this novella. It's based in the, is it, it's
1400s? 1400s, yeah.
1400s, yes. So the 1400s, around Richard II's rule. So he's still a boy king at the time. And it follows the character of Gregory, who is a grumpy, gruff knight with a somewhat jaded heart of gold. And I'm a little bit hot and cold when it comes to historical fiction. I can either love it or absolutely hate it. And I loved this. So for anyone out there, whether you are into historical fiction or not, or whether you prefer something, or whether you avoid it because you tend to find that it's too heavily saturated with facts, or that the characters aren't ultimately likable, I really, really, really do recommend this book. And it's not just because I love Jules with all my heart and soul. I really genuinely adore this book. Highly, highly recommended. It's just come out. So that's Revolt, The King's Knight, Book Number One by J.A. Ironside.
Thank you very much. I am actually surprised by how addicted to the characters I have become. So.
I like to think that I've helped with that as well.
Yes, you have. Do not go to Madeline if you want to. If you want help getting away from characters that she loves.
No, it's my superpower. I can make people addicted to their own stories. If I get addicted to it, I'm like, right, we're sharing this now. And on that note, guys, we'll say thanks very much for listening, and we'll catch you guys next week.
Yeah, thanks and goodbye.
Bye.
You've been listening to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast. You can follow our podcast at podbean.com or from iTunes. For more information, visit our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/dissectingreaders, or check out our author websites at jaironside.com and madelinevaughan.com. Please note that no dragons were harmed during the making of this podcast.